And now, Virgin Most Powerful Radio is pleased to present Hands-On Apologetics with renowned Catholic author and apologist, Gary Matuta.
Welcome, everyone. It's good to be with you. Yes, you have entered into Virgin Most Powerful's Apologetics Dojo. I'm Gary Matuta, your host and sensei, I guess you could say, and it's great to be with you today. Tuesday of Holy Week, running up to Good Friday and eventually the celebration of the resurrection. And, as always, we are diving deep into explaining and defending the faith. And today we're going to talk about something kind of different, yet still part of the faith, namely art. Yes, A-R-T, art. You got to have art. What's so big about art? Is it just decorations, or does art have a function? Well, joining us after the first break is Dr. Elizabeth Lev, who is wrote a very, very interesting book, which is titled How Catholic Art Saved the Faith. And she's going to come on and explain to us how it was through the church's patronage of the arts that after the Protestant Reformation, that the faith was more powerfully proclaimed and also, in a sense, kind of errors dispersed through beautiful paintings and sculptures and so on. So Elizabeth Lev will be joining us later in this program. And as always, we will have our, we'll dive into some critical thinking exercises. For example, defining the fallacy for today will be quoting out of context. And as always, we'll meet one of the early church fathers. And today's early church father is one of those names that you don't often hear. His name is Laporius. So Laporius is our early church father for today. We're going to find out about him. He had a very interesting life. And, he's left some documents that can be valuable to show, what was the faith of the ancient church. So, as always, you are part of the program. So, if you'd like to give us a call, or especially when Dr. Lev is on, give us a call at 888-526-2151. That's 888-526-2151. Or you can always send us your questions at questions@handsonapologetics.com. That's questions@handsonapologetics.com. Love to hear from you. Maybe there is a situation where you're talking to someone about the faith, not really sure where to go, or, who knows? Maybe you just want to throw out a shout-out to everybody or talk about your favorite verse or something. We'd love to hear from you. That's questions@handsonapologetics.com. And as I said, welcome. Thank you for listening to this program. And like I said, a good number of people I know listen to this via podcast, which is awesome. In fact, let me tell you about the resource that everybody here should know. It's virginmostpowerfulradio.org website. That is the, the mother site? What would be the correct term for that? You could always go to virginmostpowerfulradio.org website and access all the awesome programming that Virgin Most Powerful puts out. Not only Hands-On Apologetics, so you can actually access all of our programs, but also Jesus 911, Terry and Jesse Show, Bible with the Barbers, Happy Hour, whatever. It's all there at your fingertips, and that enables you to download it. You can do exercises, you go mow the lawn, you could do whatever you need to do, and yet still be filled up on really good edifying material. So it's time for shout-outs for those watching live stream on YouTube and also Facebook. Hello, everybody. Great to see familiar names. Looking. Yes. Hi, everybody. Nice emojis, by the way. If you don't have access to this, it's always fun to watch the live stream chat on YouTube because whenever we give the shout-outs, there's always this explosion of emojis. Hey, Hector. Hi, Ricky. Hi, everybody. All right. So let's jump into our finding the fallacy for today. And the finding the fallacy is quoting out of context. which doesn't really meet a lot of explanation, because quoting out of context means that the fallacy is committed when you quote something divorced from its context. This is incredibly common. In fact, it's probably the most common fallacy used when you're explaining or defending the faith. You encounter it all the time. In fact, I teach middle school and high school level apologetics online for Catholic homeschool connections. And one of the things I tell all the kids, whenever somebody cites something, look it up, read a couple of verses earlier, a couple of verses later, study it in context. Because 9 out of 10 times, in fact, probably it's probably even higher than that, but 90% plus, what seems to be quoted may sound like it somehow goes against the faith, but if you read it in context, like I said, 9 times out of 10, you'll find out that the context actually shows that, no, this is being twisted, this is not giving a complete idea, something else is going on. So quoting out of context can be a very powerful way of misrepresenting material. In fact, not only quoting out of context, but also partial quotes too can be very misleading as well, which is kind of like another case of quoting out of context. For example, if you're reading Romans 8 and you start in verse 14 and you say, you quote, "For those who are led by the Spirit of God are children of God. For you have not received the spirit of slavery as to fall back into fear, but you received a spirit of adoption, through which we cry, Abba, Father. The Spirit itself witnesses with our spirit that we are children of God, and if children, then heirs, heirs of God and joint heirs with Christ." Wow, that's awesome, right? You know, you have the Spirit, witnesses that you will inherit heaven. But, you know, if you actually look it up, you find out that I stopped the quote right in the middle of the verse, because the rest of the verse 17 says, "If only we suffer with them so that we may be glorified with them." So you see how that changes everything, just leaving off that final clause. So there's a prime example of quoting out of context, or at least giving an impartial, or not impartial, but an incomplete quotation from Scripture. So that's our finding the fallacy for today, quoting out of context. And you know, I always try to give some sort of advice for how to undo fallacies. You know, not only detect them, but what do you do? And what I suggest is, if you catch somebody quoting something out of context, don't read it to them. Have them read it to you. Tell them to start a couple of verses earlier and continue reading a couple of verses later, and have them realize that what they just quoted really doesn't fit with how they're arguing, what they think that it demonstrates. Okay, so that's my little 2 cents of apologetics, you know, techniques, and that will complete our finding of the fallacy. So let's jump to Meet the Early Church Father. Like I said, this guy is not a common name, you know, even from Catholics that are pretty well read. His name is Liporius. He flourished sometime around AD 427. Liporius was a monk in Gaul. Now, Gaul, of course, is the older name for France. While he was a monk, he started coming up with some heretical doctrines, and he was obliged to leave the monastery. In other words, he was kicked out. And the poor guy wandered homeless, you know, around France. Eventually, his journeys brought him to Africa. In North Africa, he met one of the greatest Catholic teachers of all time, St. Augustine. And St. Augustine, the great doctor of the city in North Africa called Hippo, cured him of his heretical tendencies. Now, what's interesting here is that there was a local church council at Carthage. Now, folks, you might not know this, but there are a lot of councils of Carthage. It was a very active diocese. And during the Council of Carthage, probably around 426, Liporius submitted a profession of his now Reformed faith. And this is known as the Document of Amendment of Liporius. And it was forwarded to the fathers of Carthage and bishops Aurelius, Augustine, Flortinius, and Secundius, and also bishops of Gaul, along with published this and sent it also with a cover letter to the bishops of Gaul. That's what I wanted to say. Recommending that now that he's Orthodox, that he should be properly chastened and receive them as a brother. So this document of amendment is where Laporius declares his former heirs as heirs. And it's very interesting, too, because it appears that he suffered under a kind of heresy known as Nestorianism. Even though Nestorius, you know, hadn't actually invented the heresy yet, he seems to have believed that there were in Christ not just two natures inseparably united to one person, but two distinct persons, a human person and a divine person. So according to Cassian and others, he also was somewhat Pelagian as well. And we talked about that in previous broadcast, how the heresy of Nestorianism actually is also a form of Pelagianism. And what's Pelagianism, you ask? Great question. It's the belief that there really is no original sin, that we're just given a bad example by Adam and Eve. And so all we have to do is just reform our lives, and we could become acceptable to God without the aid of divine grace. So we kind of pull ourselves up by our own bootstraps, so to speak. So anyway, Augustine and these other bishops put together this document of amendment. It's sent back to France, where Laporius now professes the Orthodox faith in Christ Jesus. So that's our Meet the Early Church Father. Today it's Laporius. A fascinating story, I think. You know, gives us a glimpse into the 5th century. Coming up on the other side of the break, we'll be talking about art with Dr. Elizabeth Leff. Stay tuned.
This is Terry Barber inviting you, all the men, to a men's conference June 15th at the Sacred Heart Chapel. This is going to be a day where we're going to talk about true masculinity. You know, there's a problem in the Catholic Church today. We have very few men who love the Catholic faith. And I know a lot of the wives that I'm listening to right now are saying, I want my husband to be on fire for the faith. Send him to the men's conference. Your son, send him to the men's conference by going to virginmostpowerfulradio.org or call 877-526-2151. That's June 15th. When your husband comes back from this conference or your son, they're going to have a different view about their Catholic faith because they're going to meet three men who love Jesus and his bride, the church, and are going to instill in them a love for Christ and his church, the Eucharist, Our Lady. Bring them to virginmostpowerfulradio.org. Sign up there or call 877-526-2151. Full sheen ahead.
It is only because of your continued prayers and generous donations that Virgin Most Powerful Radio can broadcast live each weekday. We count on your spiritual and financial support because you understand the urgent need for Catholic programming that shares the gospel with clarity and charity, but without compromise. Please prayerfully consider becoming a monthly donor. You can set it up with the touch of a button on our website, CatholicRC.org.
Buying or selling your home or your business property? This is Terry Barber. Real Estate for Life underwrites the Terry and Jesse Show, and they can connect you to one of 900 pro-life real estate agents around the world. And when they receive their referral fee, they will give 80% of it to a pro-life organization. Wow! That's 80%! RealEstateForLife.org, 877-LIFE-US1.
Now, back to Hands-On Apologetics with Gary Machuda. If you'd like to join the conversation, call 888-526-2151. Here's Gary.
And welcome back, everybody, to Hands-On Apologetics. And as I mentioned earlier in the program, we're going to talk about art and also the truth and beauty of art and how Catholic art saved the faith. That is the name of the book of our guest, who's Dr. Elizabeth Lev, who's American-born art historian, who also has the great fortune of living and working in Rome. After finishing her studies at the University of Chicago in 1989, Elizabeth moved to northern Italy to do a graduate work at the University of Bologna. She teaches on the staff of the Pontifical University of the Angelicum in Rome, and as well as Christendom College. And she has a great book out that we're going to talk about, How Catholic Art Saved the Faith, The Triumph of Beauty and Truth in Counter-Reformation Art. Dr. Lev, welcome to Hands on Apologetics.
Thank you very much for having me.
Boy, it's a pleasure to finally meet you. I've enjoyed your work, and it's such a fascinating topic, too. By the way, before I begin, though, that was a truncated bio. Did I leave out any other important information?
The only thing you need to know is that if it involves art, I'm usually interested.
There you go. Great. In fact, you know, it is kind of providential that you're our guest today, because everybody knows about that the tragic fire at the Cathedral of Notre Dame. Do you have any thoughts on that? Like, what perspective from a historian, you know, historian perspective, art historian, does the fire have for us?
I have about a million perspectives on it, but one of them, I think, is obviously when you're an art historian, a work like that, which is just it's your ABCs of art history. I mean, literally, Notre Dame. That's 101 art history, and so you grow up with it, you learn about it, it becomes your friend to a certain extent, your family. I'd recently started going to Paris and doing lecturing and tours in Paris, so you know there was this great, wonderful, even deeper relationship I was developing with that church as I was getting to know it better and better, and the ins and outs, and just reading about it. So you know, it's like a friendship that got truncated a little bit too abruptly. I also think, however, that it's a magnificent structure, and it probably will be saved. As we listen to it, Catholics are going to have a hard time hearing this. You're going to have to hear a lot that they're saving it as a cultural monument or a historic icon, or they'll use all of that kind of language to get around the fact that it is a place of worship, made to worship God.
Yeah.
Made in, you know, this adoration of God by a people that are, you know, the eldest daughters of the church. I mean, a couple things I haven't heard anybody mentioning is, you know, aren't you the first nation in Europe to become Christian? And, you know, it wasn't this church your expression on the part of the kings themselves of your fidelity to the purity of the Blessed Virgin? And weren't you the people who turned it into the Temple of Reason in 1795, you know, was in the middle of the French Revolution? But nonetheless, that building, every one of your viewers or your listeners saw this last night when they watched the whole world, whether they call it a cultural icon, whether they call it just a historic monument, you saw a whole world gathered together, absolutely thoughts, prayers, feelings concentrated on that church. And that is exactly why we call it the Ecclesia. That building in flames brought a people together. That's exactly what it's supposed to do. And I'm sure when it's rebuilt, it'll be even better than ever.
Yeah. Yeah, you're absolutely right, because it certainly had, you know, a galvanizing unity, you know, a response that, you know, I felt moved. And living here in America, I've never been there. But it's kind of like it's part of the faith. It's part of our history. It's, you know, it's ours in some sense, even though, I live in a distant country.
It is very much ours. All these churches are hours. These churches, that church opens its doors at 7 o'clock in the morning. It closes at 6:45, and you go there all day long. You could just sit there in the pews and just partake of that beauty. It's just a tiny, tiny, tiny fraction of the generosity that is the Lord's generosity towards us.
Yeah. Any expectations about when it's rebuilt, whether it's going to, you know, stand up to how it was once before?
Well, I think this is going to be a very interesting moment, because there's a lot of money to rebuild it. Now, a lot of people are going to want it rebuilt as it was. But other people may argue, let's do something different. Let's leave a mark. I mean, after all, the fire happened. The thing happened. Let's leave something. So I think the debates are about to get very – we're still in the period of mourning. But afterwards, when it's time to look at the legacy, then things are going to get a little heated. That's my prediction. I don't know for sure. But I think there are going to be very differing ideas in how to rebuild the church. I know this from St. Paul's Outside the Walls in 1823, which – burnt down. And even though this was, you know, a papal commission, this is the city of Rome, it's the 19th century, there were a great many arguments about how to rebuild it. So I imagine what's going to happen. I'm just hoping they're not going to stick an I am pay pyramid in the middle of it. That's all I'm asking.
That's true. And you know, that's something you wouldn't expect in the art world, where everything is so calm and peaceful and, you know, everybody looks at things the same way, you know.
Oh, yes. No, nothing. There's no need to shock and surprise and scandalize and awaken, you know, the poor sleeping populace with their,
Yeah. Well, thank you. Like I said, it's really providential to have you on to be able to share that with us. But let's talk Reformation and also what's called the Counter-Reformation. You know, it's interesting that the Protestant Reformation happened. One of the contributing factors is the invention of the printing press. And so one of the reasons why Protestantism grew so much was because now it became affordable to mass print tracts and books, where before it wasn't. And the church, you know, also stood up to Protestants. They also published books. But, you know, I think that whole perspective of art was totally missed. At least I wasn't really aware of it until I saw your book.
Well, I'm glad to have brought something to light. The printing press was the amount of material being produced in the printing press was really quite remarkable. It's something like 150 million documents are circulating in Europe by mid 16th century. So you are a lot of these documents, obviously not all, but a lot of these documents are produced by these different religions that are cropping up. First, there's Luther, then there's Luther and Calvin, Calvin and Zwingli. And so each one has, you know, a proposal of how we are supposed to order our lives before God. The problem is that when the Catholic Church has to respond to something like that, the Catholic Church has to respond clearly. It has to respond choosing the correct words. We have to worry about the language we use. We have to worry about how we express things, because we are entrusted with the deposit of the faith. So you can't just write like a cute, snippy little soundbitey answer. And this is where the problem lies. The Protestants became amazing at writing these tracts. The opening lines on these things. So Martin Luther on the institution of the papacy founded by the devil. I mean, honestly, who's not going to click on that? So these incredible hyperbole. It makes it, you know, it's exciting. It's challenging. And then there is, well, we must. If dissent from this vision, it's very different. So the Catholic Church, remember, it had something in its arsenal, and that was art. And so it used the same way the Protestants used edgy, clever, eye-catching language. The Catholic Church learned to use art in that fashion.
So was this a conscious program by the church, or was this organic that Catholics just started producing art to reinforce the faith?
No, it really is a conscious program. So we have the Council of Trent that actually puts its hands in its hair for a few minutes, saying, you know, should we continue to support art? Because after all, a lot of the art in the mid-16th century had been a lot more what you and I would describe today as art for art's sake, because we were chuckling over works of art that were meant to shock or surprise or, you know, do anything except for edify you. That happens a lot in the mid-16th century. So the early part of the 16th century, there's a lot of art that kind of it borders on some deeply problematic things. So the church is wondering, why are we paying these people to put things in our churches that are unhelpful? But then the church decides it has a very old history with art, and it's worth trying again. But trying again with certain guidelines, really trying to ask the artists to rise to the occasion. So we have these amazing cardinals like Charles Borromeo, who will really write a treatise on church building, for heaven's sakes. And you have another cardinal, the unsung hero of the Counter-Reformation, Gabriele Paleotti of Bologna, who wrote a treatise specifically for painters, in which he does not talk down to them. He invites them to join the ranks of the theologians as mute theologians. Use your brushes to preach as we do. He shares the tricks of the trade in preaching. So there is a real collaboration between prelates, priests, religious orders, and artists, which was unbelievably fruitful.
Yeah. Yeah, boy, I didn't realize it was there was so much hands-on cooperation. Usually, you hear about patronage, you know, the church endowing science and endowing arts, but this was actually kind of exhorting faithful artists to rise to the occasion.
And sometimes artists that were a little bit of trouble. So we have a Caravaggio who will get many commissions from the inner circle of the Pope himself, even though Caravaggio was a very, very troubled character, extremely difficult to work with. The last person you would make a poster child for the Catholic Church, yet somehow knew to how to transmit in a powerful, edgy, strong, vibrant way the battle between good and evil that was raging in people's souls. The Pope himself, Clement VIII Aldo Brandini, personally, and I mean personally, commissioned a man named Barocci to paint an altarpiece of the Eucharistic altarpiece for his parents' chapel. And our Gabriele Paleotti, again, my favorite, he is the one who hired the first woman painter, professional woman painter, or woman painter in general, to do an altarpiece in a church. You want to know a man's game in the Renaissance? Altarpieces. But Lavinia Fontana, thanks to Gabriele Paleotti, became an altarpiece painter in Bologna and ultimately even in the Alma Città, the ancient city of Rome.
Wow. Wow, that's fantastic. Well, we're coming up on our first break. So maybe on the other side of the break, I'd like to talk a little bit more about Caravaggio, because he seems like such an interesting character, and yet he's done such spectacular work too. So if that sounds okay with you.
Great. Sounds great with me. I love talking about Caravaggio.
Excellent. Well, listen to Hands On Apologetics, and we have Dr. Elizabeth Lev with us talking about how Catholic art saved the faith. More on the other side of the breaks, folks, so stay tuned.
This is Terry Barber inviting you, all the men, to a men's conference June 15th at the Sacred Heart Chapel. This is going to be a day where we're going to talk about true masculinity. You know, there's a problem in the Catholic Church today. We have very few men who love the Catholic faith. And I know a lot of the wives that I'm listening to right now are saying, I want my husband to be on fire for the faith. Send him to the men's conference. Your son, send him to the men's conference by going to virginmostpowerfulradio.org or call 877-526-2151. That's June 15th. When your husband comes back from this conference or your son, they're going to have a different view about their Catholic faith because they're going to meet three men who love Jesus and his bride, the church, and are going to instill in them a love for Christ and his church, the Eucharist, Our Lady. Bring them to virginmostpowerfulradio.org. Sign up there or call 877-526-2151. Full sheen ahead.
It is only because of your continued prayers and generous donations that Virgin Most Powerful Radio can broadcast live each weekday. We count on your spiritual and financial support because you understand the urgent need for Catholic programming that shares the gospel with clarity and charity, but without compromise. Please prayerfully consider becoming a monthly donor. You can set it up with the touch of a button on our website, catholicrc.org.
Buying or selling your home or your business property? This is Terry Barber. Real Estate for Life underwrites the Terry and Jesse Show, and they can connect you to one of 900 pro-life real estate agents around the world. And when they receive their referral fee, they will give 80% of it to a pro-life organization. Wow! That's 80%! RealEstateForLife.org, 877-LIFE-US1.
This is Jesse Romero. You're listening to Hands-On Apologetics with Gary Machuda on Virgin Most Powerful Radio.
And welcome back, everybody. We are chatting with Dr. Elizabeth Lev on her book, How Catholic Art Saved the Faith, The Triumph and the Beauty of the Counter-Reformation Art, and which is available through Sophia Institute Press. So you definitely want to pick it up if you get a chance. It's a beautiful book. And, you know, Doctor, before the break, you mentioned Caravaggio and how, you know, the Catholic bishops were trying to rouse artists to join with them in proclaiming, reaffirming the faith. And he seems like a very unlikely character in some ways because he doesn't seem like a very saintly guy.
No, he wasn't. Art's life is known to us mostly through police records, of which there were about 40, and wow, most of them were for aggression. Yes, he tragically was licensed to carry a sword and carried it and would pull it out at most inopportune occasions. Caravaggio is a fascinating case of a man who never, ever would have succeeded in the Renaissance. Had it just stayed the age of Michelangelo and Raphael and Leonardo, there never would have been a chance for Caravaggio. He didn't draw, he didn't fresco, he didn't know really some of the fundamental techniques that those kind of professional painters were taught. All he had was this gift with oil paint, this fury, this courage of a style that didn't really prepare canvases. He just kind of walked up and started painting. He had an ability to draw out very, very naturalistic details. And then he would take these ordinary, gritty people with dirty feet and mussed up clothes, and he would shoot a supernatural light, a light from an unknown source that would cut through the darkness and illuminate that scene. So Caravaggio, what he had, this amazing gift to take the ordinary and turn it into extraordinary.
Wow. So is that kind of like film, was it film noir? I can't think of the name. The style of film where it's dark, but the lighting is very dramatic.
Yes, exactly. That was a very, very successful style, particularly in those kind of those very intellectual thrillers where there's kind of a lot of trying to figure out what people's motives and what they're thinking about. And that's actually a really kind of good adaptation of what Caravaggio was doing. Caravaggio's technique was a kind of a mixture. In one case, it was something called tenebrism, which means he has a heavy, heavy use of shadows. And in the paintings of Caravaggio, what you'll notice is different between the paintings he does in 1590 and 1600 and 1605 from the paintings that Michelangelo and Raphael and Leonardo are doing 100 years earlier, is that Caravaggio doesn't give you any kind of background. He gives you this blank, dark slate. So the figures emerge from the darkness. Then in the Renaissance, when you would make all the figures very beautiful, they were always idealized, you and I would say photoshopped today. You find the most perfect figures, the most elegant figures. But Caravaggio would bring out something that makes these people look like you picked up your laundry from them this morning, and I think that guy works on your car. I mean, they feel very ordinary and very regular. But this light, this film noir effect of having a beam of light come in, it literally cuts through the heavy shadows he creates, and it illuminates very specific things. So the viewer isn't tempted to get distracted. The viewer focuses very well. It's one of the reasons why Caravaggio is so successful today. We don't do well at focusing. We have a lot of things going on, right? We're always distracted. It's hard for us to kind of keep an eye on something, but Caravaggio makes us focus.
Yeah, that's interesting. Do you think it's because of his rough, you know, lifestyle that impacted why he portrays people as kind of run-of-the-mill, you know, people that you would find on the streets, but, you know, in partially in darkness, but you know, has this divine light that illumines. Do you think it's really from kind of his sinful lifestyle, maybe, that generated it?
I think Caravaggio's interior struggles are what made his art so powerful. He's, to me, a great deal like Mel Gibson. Mel Gibson, who every now and then you think, well, gosh, not the world's greatest personal poster child for the Catholic faith, and yet the man who made a movie that movie is part of cinematic history. It's riveting. It's riveting even 10 years later. Yeah. And the Caravaggio had that same kind of quality where you know in that movie Mel Gibson understands who the Savior is and what you're supposed to do to follow the Savior, and yet he has such a hard time doing it personally. And Caravaggio is the same thing, and it's even, for me, more moving, because Caravaggio recognized the great quality that he lacked was humility. And especially as he gets later in his life, and he's getting into more and more fights, and he's going to, you know, commit manslaughter, he'll have to be in exile in Rome, and everything gets worse and worse because he can never back down. He keeps painting these saints, these martyrs, who are such beautiful examples of humility. So it's the tension comes from a man who knows exactly what he's supposed to do. Mm-hmm. I just can't seem to do it. And our modern age, I think this resonates a lot with our modern age. But in particular, the thing that is a little disconcerting, one of the reasons why I feature Caravaggio so strongly in this book, is that people like to think so generally, oh, Caravaggio, he's a bad boy, and he's a brilliant bad boy, and he's brilliant because he's bad. This is a man who understands what he's supposed to do. He is a great magnet for us, because in our sinfulness, in the things that we do that are wrong, we do have capacity to make great beauty in our lives.
Yes, yes. Yeah, as you were talking, I was reminded of someone who gave spiritual advice that if you're going to ask for a spiritual director, it's better to get a spiritual director who's not a canonizable saint, but one who is struggling, because they can understand the struggle. Where if you have a spiritual advisor who is really advanced in the walk, they just don't understand the struggles that you're going through.
I guess that's an interesting way of seeing Caravaggio. It probably helps us to understand why he is such a potent figure for Catholics and non-Catholics.
Yes, yeah, absolutely. Now, if you can, try to explain to us, how is it that art can reinforce the faith? Because couldn't you have a Protestant artist who would depict a scene from The Passion and a Catholic artist from this period? What would be the difference between the two?
Well, the general idea is that the Catholic world sees an enchantment. I mean, Andrew Greeley many years ago wrote a book called The Catholic Imagination. And the Catholic world sees, the Catholic imagination sees the world as enchanted. We see it as something a little bit more beautiful than it is. And so in Catholic art, they really did make a point of reinforcing very specifically elements that Protestants were calling into question. So a work of the Passion, showing the Passion per se, there are going to be stylistic differences, but both parties agree that Jesus underwent the Passion. But right. Interestingly, for example, an image of, let's say, Jesus's baptism would differ. Jesus's baptism in Catholic art undergoes a transformation. You don't see Jesus sort of standing erect and John standing next to him, this sort of stiff figures posing. In Catholic art, once the Reformation happens, you see Jesus, as the water is being poured on him, he begins to bow down. So Jesus's mission is that of undertaking this obedience, this humility. And so this idea of Jesus who is going to have to do something. So there are little differences like that, and then there are huge differences. So you go from images of the Last Supper, where the focus is on the betrayal of Judas, but in the Restoration, the Catholic Reformation period, we have images of the institution of the Eucharist, and so on and so forth. So Catholics really do try to draw out of the art, something much more supernatural, transcendental. Also, and honestly, the artists in question just have much more experience in making beautiful art. And so these works tend to be more eye-catching, just like the Protestants write great headlines, Catholics make great pictures.
Yeah, yeah. And in a way, you know, we learn now with social media that you can influence people in print, but a single picture can transform lives, you know. And in a way, it was very wise for the church to not only call for people to write, you know, treaties countering the error, but to arouse the artist to reaffirm it, because, you know, a single picture could be totally transformative, where a treatise, maybe only a few people would be able to read it and understand it.
Exactly. Exactly. Well, it's again, sort of like today, where most people would really just rather watch the YouTube video, right, rather than read the recipe or read this. We are a visual society. They were a visual society. And so art became a very a good way to catch people's attention, and people were very good at reading pictures. And so they could catch their attention. And the way that a lot of the art that was produced in the late 16th, early 17th century, the way it was made, was to involve viewers more. So you see images where the figures appear to be poking out of the canvas. They seem to be spaces left for you. So there's another aspect of this art which really emphasizes the involvement of the viewer. If you're going to be looking at the story, remember that you are now a witness to what is happening before your eyes, and that imposes on you the duty to testify.
Wow. Yeah, absolutely. So do you find the same parallel among Protestant artists, or is that more passive and, you know, not as inviting?
The Protestants are going to have a big argument about art, all right? So some of them are going to be iconoclasts. The Anabaptists don't want to hear it. One of Martin Luther's closest friends was Lucas Cranach the Elder, who produces these satiric woodcuts of the Pope. And then there's art that tends to be very kind of grisly regarding Jesus's passion. This is a lot of imagery which can be very, very brutal. But remember, as the Protestants remove saints from the picture, they lose a huge body of subject matter for them to produce art in. So, you know, it's very hard to keep up with the Catholic Church in for the Protestants, at least in art.
Wow, that's a fantastic point. We're talking with Dr. Elizabeth Lev about how Catholic art saved the faith. More to come after this break. Stay tuned, everyone.
This is Terry Barber inviting you, all the men, to a men's conference June 15th at the Sacred Heart Chapel. This is going to be a day where we're going to talk about true masculinity. You know, there's a problem in the Catholic Church today. We have very few men who love the Catholic faith. And I know a lot of the wives that I'm listening to right now are saying, I want my husband to be on fire for the faith. Send him to the men's conference. Your son, send him to the men's conference by going to virginmostpowerfulradio.org or call 877-526-2151. That's June 15th. When your husband comes back from this conference, or your son, they're going to have a different view about their Catholic faith, because they're going to meet three men who love Jesus and his bride, the church, and are going to instill in them a love for Christ and his church, the Eucharist, Our Lady. Bring them to virginmostpowerfulradio.org. Sign up there or call 877-526-2151. Full sheen ahead.
It is only because of your continued prayers and generous donations that Virgin Most Powerful Radio can broadcast live each weekday. We count on your spiritual and financial support because you understand the urgent need for Catholic programming that shares the gospel with clarity and charity, but without compromise. Please prayerfully consider becoming a monthly donor. you can set it up with the touch of a button on our website, CatholicRC.org.
Buying or selling your home or your business property? This is Terry Barber. Real Estate for Life underwrites the Terry and Jesse Show, and they can connect you to one of 900 pro-life real estate agents around the world. And when they receive their referral fee, they will give 80% of it to a pro-life organization. Wow! That's 80%! RealEstateForLife.org, 877-LIFE-US1.
Now, back to Hands-On Apologetics with Gary Machuda. If you'd like to join the conversation, call 888-526-2151. Here's Gary.
And welcome back, everybody. We're talking with Dr. Elizabeth Lev of her fantastic book, How Catholic Art Saved the Faith, The Triumph of Beauty and Truth in Counter-Reformation Art. And right before the break, you mentioned something. I was thinking of an old quote I read years ago that it was by a Catholic apologist who said, when Protestants destroyed the stained glass and statues in their churches, they were really destroying the Bibles of the poor. And what you mentioned right before the break was not only were they destroying the Bibles of the poor, but they were also destroying kind of our family album as well, you know, about the saints and, you know, Catholicism in general.
I love that image of the family album. That's a really beautiful thing. That's, you know, when we go to Mass here, especially right now, it's Lent, and so every morning we go to a different one of the station churches. You know, these churches during the 40 days of Lent were in the just from the ancient times of the church, the Pope would go celebrate Mass in a different church in Rome every day, and as you're in these churches and you're, you know, next to the relics of St. Agnes or Cecilia, and you hear the Roman canon, you know, there are Peter and Paul, and there they are, they're all around you. And that's really for those who couldn't be here and be really next to the remains of Peter and Paul. It's really quite beautiful to be able to evoke them in these images. So yes, that family album, I'm going to be borrowing that from you.
Okay. I'm honored. Thank you. Yeah. My experience, I have only been to Rome once, but the paintings, it's almost as if you can walk through a room and you're looking into another room and it's filled with saints, you know, and it really does evoke this idea that not only these are, you know, our great brothers and sisters in the past, but they're alive. You know, they're close to us. They're not something distant and cut off.
As a matter of fact, the church used already in the Renaissance, we started to develop a type of painting called a sacred conversation. And in the sacred conversation, you would see Mary and Jesus, usually slightly, the baby Jesus, slightly elevated in some kind of throne. And there would be a group of saints standing around at the bottom. And so first of all, you would just sort of see, oh, look, it really looks like fun. I'd really like to be part of that group someday. Then artists like Raphael and Perugino started to have one of them looking out at you like, hey, why don't you come join the party? And what happens in Counter-Reformation art is that they start to leave spaces for you. So you'll see like a little gaping hole in the middle, like, hey, come join the conversation, or hey, you know, we're waiting for you. So this way that one of the things that, you know, as Martin Luther kept saying, you know, cut out the middleman, have a personal relationship with God. The Catholic Church really emphasized, yes, we have a personal relationship with God. Of course we do. But we also have a friendship with our brothers and sisters, the saints.
Yeah. Yeah. So what other topics that would be distinctively Catholic that would come out of this period that was emphasized by these artists?
Well, so I was very interested in the problem of the sacraments, and that's a very kind of very solid, clear way of understanding that, yes, of course, the Protestants are contesting numerous aspects of the sacraments, particularly the sacrament of confession. But there was also the problem of intercession, and, you know, why do we pray Why do we pray to saints? Why do we invoke saints? But the part that I really enjoyed writing the most was the part that dealt with cooperation. And that's the trickiest part. How do we participate in Jesus' salvific sacrifice? So where you have Martin Luther, sin and sin boldly, I mean, talk about another one of those great clickbait lines, or you have a... justification, but he stays alone. What's the point of, you know, Catholics going out and doing these crazy things like pilgrimages and fasting and all that nonsense? I mean, it's like borrowing $5 from your dad to go buy him a Father's Day present. But the Catholic Church really began to emphasize in a very beautiful way the struggles in living one's life in the faith and the fact that one must be proactive in the faith. So one of my favorite parts of the book is actually the section on doubt, where the Protestant Reformation understands, the Catholic Restoration understands that the Protestants have flooded the world with questions. Should I believe this? Should I believe that? Should I believe this? Should I believe that? And doubt is going to be normal. And doubt is something that everybody felt, that Thomas felt, that Peter felt. The saints themselves have doubted. But the saints themselves understood part of the struggle of getting closer to Christ is to overcome doubt. So it's just, that's just one thing. But for me, that was very moving. I remember reading, being touched by Pope Benedict the 16th, when he wrote that the place where the believer and the unbeliever can find a common ground is in the question of doubt. And so it really resonated that, you know, 500 years earlier, the church had been exploring questions like this in art.
Yeah. Does any particular painting jump out at you as, kind of typifying this?
Oh, yes, it's Caravaggio. I figure with it, why leave a great thing behind? Caravaggio has a little-known painting. I mean, it's, if you're a Caravaggio fan, you know it. But it's not something like the one that shows up all the time, like Calling of Matthew. And it's a painting called Doubting Thomas. It's a small painting. It was actually not commissioned for a church. It was commissioned for somebody's home who obviously struggled with these kinds of questions. And it shows it's a frame that has four bodies, and they're so pushed up against the edge of the canvas. Like you were saying before, in the Renaissance, they kind of make a space and they put the figures in the back of the space. Caravaggio draws those figures. It's as if they're standing right in front of you, and they're the same size you are, all right, if you ever go see it in person. And Jesus stands to the side, this beautiful, illuminated figure. He's just this very simple, kind of creamy white figure, and he's baring his side, and three figures, Thomas and two other apostles, are literally peering over him. They make a cross shape in the composition, these four heads. And Thomas has his finger physically in Jesus' side as Jesus holds his hand and guides it into the wound. So Jesus, who welcomes, he understands. But at the same time, what does he say to Thomas? Yes, Thomas, you have seen and you have believed, but blessed are those who have not seen and still believed. And the best part of this painting is that these four heads that make this cross shape, there's one little space below. There's a little empty space right underneath Jesus' wound, and you know Caravaggio left that space for you. Because if any one of us had been the apostles in that room and Jesus was showing the wounds, we would not have been sitting on the other side of the room going, oh, yeah, no, I'm good, I believe.
Right
up there with them.
Yeah. Wow, that's powerful. Right after this broadcast, I'm going to Google it because I'm not familiar with it. It sounds intriguing.
Doubting Caravaggio, beautiful.
Very good. Well, Dr. Love, how can we adapt what they used during the Counter-Reformation today? Is there any carryover for today? Should we look for kind of restoration of the arts, or is there mediums that are similar that Catholics can use to share the faith in the same kind of dramatic way?
Well, I think it's safe to say that we are in a period that is not dissimilar to the period before the Council of Trent, where artists do what they want. They want to catch attention. They claim to be sharing some kind of common experience, but usually the common experience is experience that we would like to rise above as Catholics. And it was the determined commissioning and interest in art on the part of not only the church, but people. That painting, that magnificent Caravaggio painting I was just telling you about, it was for somebody's home. And I think one of the things that I've been really strongly stressing is try putting some Catholic art in your home. Stop worrying about the feng shui tulips that look nice in the living room and start thinking about finding a picture that you like. It can be an old picture, a reproduction that you frame, or something new that you like, but something that makes you get to know one of these saints better, something that you begin to know the story, the ins and outs, the details of the painting, and you want to share with people this great work of art. I've been very, very fortunate since I write for Magnificat every now and then. And Magnificat allows me to write about contemporary living artists. So I get to bring to people's attention people who are trying to revive art today.
Yeah, yeah, very good. You know, that's exactly my experience. When I was growing up, you know, in late 60s, early 70s, when you went into a Catholic home, you knew it was a Catholic home because they had Catholic art. There's crucifixes. But, you know, today you could walk into a Catholic home and it looks indistinguishable from any other home. There's not Catholic art or Catholic paraphernalia. And, yeah, I mean, that squares perfectly with my experience.
Right. You know, I grew up with Filippo Lippi's beautiful Madonna and Child, and that's always who the Madonna is going to be for me.
Yeah, yeah, very good. You know, one thing that that struck me is when you were saying that is that there's something about art that immediately draws you to meditation and contemplation. You know, it beckons you to do that. Where I don't think in the written word. It's certainly not on YouTube, you know, it's more just passively absorbing. Having Catholic art in the home would, when you have visitors, you can point out the meaning, you know, what you get out of the picture.
I mean, it's a lot better than talking about what happened on the latest installment of whatever television series you're watching. I mean, that's what we do today. But people used to talk about their paintings. People used to talk about what they liked about them. They talked about the stories. And once upon a time, people used to talk about stories of the saints the way they talk about the celebrities' raucous love lives.
Right. Yeah. Very good. Well, man, I can't believe our hour has flown. Where can people go to keep abreast of all the work you've been doing?
Well, I have a website, elizabeth-lev.com, and there I keep a fair amount of what I'm doing when I keep up. And you'll find there a lot of the books I've written and the articles I've produced.
Excellent. Well, thank you so much for coming on the program. We appreciate it.
Thank you very much for having me. And it was a fun conversation, too.
Yes, well, it's absolutely. And that is Dr. Elizabeth Lev, folks. Check it out. Great book, How Catholic Art Saved the Faith, The Triumph of Beauty and Truth in Counter-Reformation Art. Coming up tomorrow, Carl Keating, the man who started the modern Catholic apologetics movement in America, is coming to the dojo. We're going to pick yet another book that every single Catholic apologist ought to know and read. Thursday, Dawn Eden Goldstein is going to come talk about our conversion story from Judaism to Catholicism. Then Friday, Trent Horn to talk about his brand new book, Counterfeit Christ. And it's time for me to shut down the Midwest Command Center here and turn off the lights at the dojo. Thank you so much for listening to the program. We appreciate it. Coming up next, the dynamic duo of Catholic Talk Radio, the Terry and Jesse Show. Don't want to miss it, folks. High intensity Catholic talk coming at you. I wish everybody have a blessed day, and God willing, I'll talk to you tomorrow. Bye-bye.
In the 1990s, I lived and worked in Hollywood. But when my wife Betty's mom took ill, we relocated to Orange County. And it was during this time in our lives that I converted to Catholicism. Once my eyes were opened to the truth, I couldn't learn enough about the faith. But I had less free time than ever, especially with a long commute. That's when I discovered the real value of Catholic audio. Listening to cassette tapes transformed my daily commute into a miniature retreat. And that's the beauty of Virgin Most Powerful Radio today. Since the podcasts are archived, you can listen anytime on our smartphone app. I know how listening to Catholic audio can bring you closer to Christ and His Church. So I encourage you to visit the App Store or go to vmpr.org and download the app today. It just might change your life. I'm Matthew Arnold for Virgin Most Powerful Radio.
Virgin Most Powerful Radio, sharing the gospel with clarity and charity.